Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and happy first snow day of 2018. Don't you love when they come up with these new words for the weather? Like it's some kind of branding exercise in a marketing class today. It's bomb cyclone. That's very nuclear war, isn't it? I don't know if it's appropriate for weather. Bomb cyclone. When Sandy arrived in our area back in 2012, it wasn't a hurricane anymore. It was called a post-tropical cyclone. Remember that? And did you ever hear that term before Sandy, if you're not a meteorology major? How about polar vortex? That's what they said was the cause of a long cold snap a few winters ago. Did you ever hear polar vortex, vortex before then? And some reports are, by the way, that we'll get another polar vortex right on the back end of the bomb cyclone causing the near zero cold we're expecting this weekend. They also say we could get thunder snow today. At least that term tells you what it is. And that's pretty cool to watch, actually. I've seen lightning during a snowstorm, have you? And what is a blizzard exactly anyway, even though that's not at all a new term in these parts? Anyway, later this hour, we'll talk to a meteorologist or a climate expert so he can get geeky about what's going on in the atmosphere and a little about its relationship to the climate. And we'll also take your calls on what a snow day like this means in your home. Like if it's too blizzardy to go sledding and make snow people, what do you do with the kids? If you live in a house, how many times do you go out and shovel? And we'll follow up on our morning edition report about how not to blow all your resolutions here on January 4th just because it's a snow day. You know, you don't have to eat all the junk food in your refrigerator or go shopping online all day just because there's nothing else to do, or it seems like there's nothing else to do. There actually are other things to do. And we'll invite your calls to help each other with that. That's all coming up. Our first guest, however, joining us right now is Mother Jones, Washington Bureau Chief David Korn, to help us understand the bomb cyclone of news in the Russia investigation in the last few days, which even now includes Steve Bannon saying that Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. acted treasonously in their 2016 campaign dealings with the Russians, to which Sarah Huckabee Sanders gave the president's reaction yesterday.
I think furious, disgusted would probably certainly fit.
And with that, David Korn, welcome back to WNYC.
Always good to be with you, Brian. Was wondering how you were going to combine this with the weather, but you did.
There's always a way. And, you know, I didn't want to start with the Bannon stuff, and I'm not sure that I want to dwell on it first here because there's more substantive Russian investigation stuff out there. But we may now have a First Amendment issue brewing just in the last few minutes. I don't know if you've seen this yet, but one of the notifications that I just got from the Washington Post says Trump lawyers warn the author of the book, Michael Wolff, the book Fire and Fury that's coming out with these Bannon quotes, warns the publisher of Fire and Fury. Oh, it just disappeared from my screen. Give me a minute. I'm going to bring it back up. There it is. Trump lawyers warn Fire and Fury author publisher to stop the release of the book. It's due out in a few days, saying its false statements are being investigated. So did you know that until I just said it?
No, I saw the Washington Post just put that up. I had that about 33 minutes ago. So I had seen the notification too. I was too busy getting ready for you. And of course, they did send last night a cease and desist letter to Stephen Bannon, citing some non-disclosure agreement he apparently signed, which might have been more with Trump and the Trump Organization rather than with the White House. I don't think you can do that at the White House, although Trump might try. You know, suggesting they might sue him should he continue to talk about any of his interactions with Trump. So I think you're right to cast this as a First Amendment issue if indeed they are going to pursue these legal actions. Now, we have to say, you know this as well as I do from covering Donald Trump for many, many, many years, he often acts litigious, but then never pulls the trigger. He threatened to sue a dozen women who made accusations against him of sexual harassment or assault, and not once did he sue them. He threatened to sue the New York Times over its story about that, and he didn't sue the Times either. So he often talks a big game about these sort of lawsuits, but then never goes through with them. So I think we'll have to wait and see. My guess is that the publisher is not going to heed this warning, and probably just, you know, and they probably all have recently seen the movie The Post and will be motivated by that to go ahead with publication.
How about the non-disclosure agreement that Trump claims Bannon signed? Of course, non-disclosure agreements have been in the news with respect to Me Too in the last few months. Women who brought sexual harassment claims in workplaces and then settled them in ways that included non-disclosure agreements, which of course set up other women to be harassed because the companies required those things and the word couldn't get out about the dangers. What would a non-disclosure agreement be with respect to a departing White House official?
Well, in this case, the non-disclosure agreement is something that Bannon signed with the Trump Organization. Apparently it was an employment agreement with the Trump Organization, meaning that when he signed on as a Trump advisor, he became director of his campaign in August of 2016, he actually became an employee of the Trump Organization, which is weird in and of itself. And these non-disclosure agreements, which Trump routinely made people sign. I've spoken to others who worked on the early days of his campaign who were being paid out of the Trump Organization itself, I believe. And these agreements tend to say you can't talk about anything we talk about, and they often have a non-disparagement clause, meaning you can't talk critically about Donald Trump, his organization, or his projects. Now, would that, you know, that might cover, I'm not saying it would, I'm not a lawyer, it might cover what happened before entering the White House. It's hard to imagine that you could, you know, extend it to cover what happened within the White House. And having sent a cease and desist letter citing the non-disclosure agreement, you know, that all that means is that they are threatening to sue Bannon. A cease and desist letter has no power of law in and of itself. And so the question would be, then would they go ahead and actually go through with a lawsuit and put him on the stand and talk about all sorts of things that might have happened between him and Trump and the Trump Organization? I think this is mainly a threat, and would find it unlikely that they go ahead with this, and would find it even further unlikely to think that this could be considered to cover anything that happened once Bannon was working in the White House, where his employee was not Donald Trump, but you and I, the taxpayers, who pay for the U.S. government.
He's not a lawyer, but he is a journalist. David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, with us as our first guest on this snow day. By the way, breaking news from Twitter. One listener says it's easier when you have kids who are teenagers when it's a snow day. All three of my teens are still sleeping, writes this listener. I'm making homemade cinnamon rolls. We'll talk more about the snow day later. And you can call in as a snow day activity, so you don't spend the whole day breaking your New Year's resolutions and just eating junk out of the refrigerator and shopping online. If you want to talk to David Korn about any of this, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We'll come back to the Bannon stuff, but I want to go what might be a little more substantive, and you've been pointing out in your first answer how the Bannon back and forth with Trump, maybe especially from the Trump side, is just bluster. But a little more substantive with the New York Times article the other day explaining how Trump campaign aide George Papadopoulos triggered the FBI investigation into collusion with Russia in a drunken reveal to, of all people, the Australian ambassador to the UK. Wait, what? Did that story fill in an important missing piece of the puzzle for you?
Yes, it did, actually, because one thing that we didn't know for sure, and I've been reporting on this, I'm working on a book on this with Michael Isikoff, and we've been digging into this, but one thing that wasn't known for sure was what actually triggered the FBI investigation into possible contacts between Trump or Trump associates and Russians back in July 2016 during the campaign. We know from James Comey's own testimony last year that the FBI initiated a counterintelligence investigation in that month, in July, about the time that WikiLeaks dumped the Russian-hacked emails out of the Democratic Party, the DNC. But it was unclear, you know, what went into this. We had some ideas. By that point in time, Chris Steele's dossier, set of memos, you know, at least the first one or two, had been shared with the FBI. A Trump foreign policy advisor named Carter Page earlier that month had gone to Russia to give Moscow to give a speech and had met with some Russians, and that might have triggered some interest in the FBI, whether the Russians were trying to infiltrate the campaign through him or whether he was trying to, you know, cut a deal with the Russians. That's all fuzzy as well. But interesting, the Republicans and conservatives who've been trying to push back on the whole Mueller investigation and try to kill the congressional investigations have made a case. Their case is that the FBI investigation was mainly triggered by the Steele memos. And they say the Steele memos were funded by the Democratic Party and the Hillary campaign, which are true. The research for that was funded by the Democrats. And so their argument, their narrative has been, this is all one great political ruse and hoax. The Democrats paid for these memos, and these memos triggered the FBI investigation. So it's all the fruit of a poisoned tree. Well, what we learned from the New York Times story, my hat's off to them, and I'm a little upset that, I'm jealous that they got this story.
You wanted this story.
Of course, everybody wanted this story. This is one of the key elements that we've been trying to figure out. And it's something that the FBI could have told us, but of course they don't reveal these things openly. So what the New York Times told us is that in May of 2016, this 28-year-old foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign, who no one had ever heard of before, a guy named George Papadopoulos, was in London, a night, as you said, of heavy drinking, and he told the Australian ambassador to England that he had just had a meeting with a sort of a Russian intermediary, a professor in London, but who was in the process of putting Papadopoulos in contact with Russians to talk to sort of form a back-channel communication between the campaign and Moscow, that he just had a meeting along these lines, and he was told that the Russians had dirt on Clinton, including thousands of emails.
Right.
May 2016. No one knows about the DNC hack until June, middle of June of 2016. So the ambassador hears this, and he's kind of interested. Who is this young guy talking to the Russians about dirt and Hillary? But doesn't, he reports it back to his superiors in the Australian Foreign Ministry. But then, not until after the leak comes out in terms of the material being released, the emails being released in July, right before the convention by WikiLeaks, in what is now our intelligence community says was a Russian operation. After that happens, the Australians contact the American government, and says, a couple months ago, we heard from someone on the Trump campaign that the Russians had all these emails. And we don't know what it means, but, you should look into this. And that seems to have given the FBI the impetus, the major impetus, even though there were these other things going on, to say we need to look at contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia for two reasons. I'm sorry I'm going on long here, but I'll finish up for two reasons. One reason is to see whether the Trump campaign or anyone associated was colluding with the Russians in these operations against Democrats. And the other was to see if the Russians were trying somehow to infiltrate the Trump campaign and get information on the guy who might become president. So that was, the two reasons they were interested in this connection.
So, and I'm glad you went through it in that detail, because it is complicated and it has those various moving parts, and I think you just explained it pretty well. And I imagine there are a whole bunch of listeners right now who knew vaguely that New York Times article has been out there for a few days, but didn't get what it was or why it matters. I'll add one piece. Papadopoulos has pleaded guilty in the Mueller investigation to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russians. So what does this article explaining how what Papadopoulos did in that role of a campaign official, you know, leading to opening the FBI investigation. What does it do to Trump's defense against anything that Papadopoulos spills to Mueller, that Papadopoulos was just a volunteer, a coffee boy?
Well, you know, that anytime someone gets in trouble, it's like, you know, Trump's attitude is never heard of him, never saw him. And that, it goes through sort of his whole organization. There was a guy named Felix Sater, who was a felon who he did business deals with, asked about it during the campaign. He said, I wouldn't even recognize the guy. Well, it turned out he was in business with him at that particular moment as well. Paul Manafort, when he gets, you know, indicted, oh, you know, he worked with us kind of in some vague way for a couple weeks. Now, you know, don't really know the guy. He also lives in the Trump Tower. So that just seems to be their go-to play when something like this happens. I mean, Papadopoulos, I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, how people like Carter Page and Papadopoulos became foreign policy advisors to the Trump campaign. You know, usually, you know, there are people who the foreign policy community and even maybe readers of the New York Times and listeners of WNYC would recognize. Former senators, former state, you know, secretary of states, former ambassadors. In this case, the Trump campaign could find almost no establishment figures with experience in foreign policy to be foreign policy advisors other than Senator Jeff Sessions and Michael Flynn, who had been fired as head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. And so they were really desperate to get almost anybody. So they end up getting Papadopoulos, who is a 28-year-old fellow who was an unpaid intern at a think tank in Washington and now is living in London, calling himself an energy consultant. Unclear whether he was doing any real work as an energy consultant. But he did attend the meetings, and he did come in and tell the Trump team, I have Russian contacts. I know we want to do better with the Russians, and I could maybe set up a meeting between us and the Russians or between Trump and Putin. And they basically said, go at it. You know, go see what you can do. They never told him to stop.
Well, let me dispute that based on the Times article, because this is a caveat. And when we talk about the Russia investigation, we're always trying on this show, as I think you are too, to say what's there and what's not there.
Exactly.
So the Times article does also describe Papadopoulos trying to travel to Russia for the campaign and trying to broker a Putin-Trump meeting during the campaign.
Right.
But campaign supervisors, Sessions and others, rejected these suggestions. So is it fair to conclude that George Papadopoulos was trying to get the campaign to collude more explicitly with the Russians than Trump and his senior staff were actually willing to do?
Good question. There are two things that Papadopoulos was trying to do. He kept trying to talk about a Trump-Putin meeting. And at some point, Manafort says, we're not doing these type of meetings. You know, Trump doesn't like to travel, and we're not seeing foreign leaders. We're not doing it. But he said, you know, a low-level meeting would be more in keeping with what we should do. So they were throwing cold water on the grand idea of a Trump-Putin meeting. But Papadopoulos was also informing his superiors, including Sam Clovis, who was the policy director for the campaign, that he was still talking to these Russian contacts about setting up a back-channel communication between the campaign and Putin's office. I mean, Putin's office. So, and that he might go over there himself to talk to people about this. And they never said no to that. You know, it was unclear how much they encouraged it, but he was informing them what was happening, and no one ever said, no, we don't want you to be in contact with the Russians. I mean, and it's kind of a theme throughout the campaign. Again and again and again, we see contacts between, you know, some Trump associates and Russians. No one ever thinks, well, we shouldn't be doing this, or we should tell people about it, such as the, you know, the famous meeting now at Trump Tower in June of 2016 between Don Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner, and a Russian emissary who they thought was going to give them dirt on Clinton. So it's quite clear that throughout the campaign, there was this, at least an attitude or an approach that, you know, there was, you know, we can talk to the Russians, we can even get dirt from the Russians and get information from the Russians, and it's not a problem, even though from June on, there were media reports and then other reports indicating that the Russians were actually messing around in the election.
David
and that's why I think, and I'll go back to Steve Bannon, because I think this is like one of the few first times I've ever agreed with Steve Bannon. And I'm not saying that the meeting was treasonous, but what I'm saying, but what I have said is the fact that they had that meeting in June and didn't say anything about it, you know, is, I think, you know, people can come to their own conclusions. I think it's pretty lousy. But more important, once the Russians and WikiLeaks start putting out the stolen emails, and for the rest of the campaign, Donald Trump and others keep saying the Russians aren't doing this. You know, it's some 400-pound guy sitting in his mom's basement in New Jersey. They kept denying Russian meddling again and again and again. Well, they knew that the Russians were trying to help Trump and had some dirt. They didn't get it at that meeting. And so they, more than you and I or anybody else, knew that, had reason to believe the Russians were involved, and they just kept denying it outright. And then Donald Trump in mid-August gets his first intelligence briefing by the intelligence community as the Republican nominee, which is routine, and he's told in that meeting that the intelligence assessment is that the Russians were behind the hacks and the dumps that had happened already by then. And then he still denies this. So that, to me, is like one of the biggest points that I think often gets overlooked, because by denying the Russians are involved, he's giving cover to the operation, and he's making it harder for the Clinton campaign and for the White House to make a case that the Russians are doing this and something has to be done to stop them.
By the way, a snow day update from listener Helen on Twitter, who writes, combating bombogenesis by pot roasting a leg of lamb and listening to WNYC. Thank you, Helen. And we'll get to more of those calls later in the hour. We continue now with David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, on the new developments in the Russia investigation. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Susan on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Susan, thanks so much for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Good morning, Brian. I'm not a journalist, so I don't take notes when I hear these things, and my memory isn't the greatest, but I seem to recall, whether it's the Steele memos or other memos that were looking for dirt on Donald Trump, that these memos started with a Republican rival to Trump for the nomination. And if my memory is accurate, I would like to know why on your show, Brian, and on other reports, every time I hear this story talked about, it starts with the Clinton campaign and the DNC, and nobody goes back to the fact that the source was originally a Republican rival to Trump for the nomination.
It's true, and it's an important fact. I think it is one that we mention when we talk about the origins of the Steele dossier. Fair enough that it hasn't come up in this conversation that way, because we've been talking about that period in 2016 where the Clinton campaign had already taken over the funding of it. But David, anything you want to say in response to Susan?
I will just say, and as the person who first wrote about the Steele memos a week before the election, and I got into this in that article, it's pretty clear that the group that funded this, that was hired by the, there was that funded, let's say, that paid Steele to do the memos, was called Fusion GPS. They were initially hired, it is true, by a conservative publication, Washington Free Beacon, to do opposition research on Donald Trump. That, you know, funding dried up, and it dried up, and Fusion then turned to the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign and got the project continued with funding from those two sources. It was after that transition that Steele was retained by Fusion GPS. So while he was working for Fusion GPS, all the funding at that point was coming from Democratic sources.
And then coincidentally, and Susan, thank you so much, coincidentally to the drunken Papadopoulos article from the Times that we've been talking about, the two people who lead Fusion GPS, which picked up the funding for Michael Steele to look further at Trump's relationship with Russia, these two Fusion GPS leaders published their own op-ed in the Times corroborating that Steele was not the first to inform the FBI about Trump and Russia connections. What pieces of the puzzle does the Fusion GPS op-ed from a couple of days ago fill in?
Well, you know, I think it's a lot of stuff that's been out there already. But what they, you know, what they've been saying is that, and we've known this, that when Steele was working for Fusion GPS, he started working in June. By the end of that month, he was sharing his material also with the FBI, and in some ways, even against the wishes of Fusion GPS, he felt so horrified by what he was finding out, that there seemed to be connections between Moscow and Trump, and that Moscow had had a campaign to cultivate and co-opt Trump for years, including dangling business projects in front of him, that he felt obliged to give it to the FBI. And in the course of doing that, you know, he ended up talking to the FBI, but not until months later. But it was pretty clear that the FBI was already, you know, on this case and had other reasons to be looking at this other than just his memos. So I think, you know, the Fusion GPS guys, Glenn Simpson and Peter Frisch, always had a very clear indication that it wasn't the Steele memos that triggered the FBI interest, although that something else was happening that led them to want more from Steele.
Now it is revealed that it seems to have been the Australian government, after hearing that stuff from Papadopoulos. But there is a knock on that Fusion GPS op-ed in the conservative press that relates to you, that you were given, as you mentioned before, the Steele dossier and access to Steele himself in October 2016, the last month of the campaign, and you wrote it up for Mother Jones as an October surprise. And to the conservative press, this indicates Steele wasn't just a disinterested British Russia expert. He was, in that context, a Clinton operative dropping dirt on Trump to a Clinton-friendly news outlet, you, while he was also dropping it to the FBI, politicizing that investigation. How do you respond to that spin on it?
Well, I understand. Spin is a good word. And to begin with, I'm not a Clinton-friendly news outlet. I can point to many stories I've written that the Clinton people would not like, and, of course, many stories that I wrote about Trump that Trump would not like.
You were certainly anti-Trump during the campaign.
Yeah. I'd say critical of Trump, and I wrote critical things about the Clinton campaign as well. But the larger point here is that Steele, you know, it's unfortunate that he can't come forward yet, because he's involved in some legal actions, and fully tell his story. As I wrote in my piece, and as I wrote again a couple months later when he became publicly known, it was clear to me that he was shocked and frightened by what he had found in doing his research. And he believed that the American public ought to know about this. He didn't really have a dog in a fight between the Democrats and the Republicans. And he says, and Fusion GPS say this too, I don't know, I can't affirm that this is true, that Steele did not know who the ultimate client was who was paying for this. He was working for Fusion GPS, as he had done projects with them for, I think, up to 8 years prior to this. But in any event, it was clear to me that Steele, as a former intelligence officer whose specialty was counterintelligence and Russia, he ended up becoming the MI6's top official on Russian counterintelligence. You know, he was aghast at what he was finding and any indication of any contact between the Trump circle in Russia would have thrown him for a loop. And he really believed that the public, the American public, needed to know about this before voting. And, you know, this is a guy who's never been in the public sphere at all. He was very, you know, he had talked to some reporters on background earlier in the campaign about Carter Page and very sort of specific parts of his memos. But he had not, you know, he was very reluctant to talk to me. And I could just feel the anguish because he, you know, I didn't quote him by name. I wasn't allowed to. That was part of our agreement. But even talking to a reporter at all seemed tremendously against every fiber of his body. Hmm. He just hated it. I can see how, you know, Republicans and conservatives have, you know, keep, you know, trying to focus on these well, I call them sideshows, even though they involve me, when and seem so less concerned with the undeniable fact that Moscow, that Putin intervened in the election. And we now know he did it to help Trump. You know, they're trying to shut down the congressional investigations. They're going after Mueller, and they really are more worried about Fusion GPS or myself or, you know, these counter-narratives than they are with holding Putin to account and making, and also even more important, making sure this never happens again. There are still positions at DHS, Department of Homeland Security, that are involved with preventing hacking of elections that aren't filled. Donald Trump has yet to say a single word warning Russia not to do this again. And I don't know. I mean, I know it's easy to come across as partisan, but if there was any one issue where you think, you know, the Republicans can join with Democrats, it would be protecting
our elections. By the way, snow day update, and here's a controversy. Listener Brooke tweets, "We are considering pranking our still-asleep teenager by telling him that school isn't canceled, but a delayed opening." So, listeners, you can weigh in on Twitter. Should Brooke prank her still-asleep teenager by telling him that school isn't canceled, but a delayed opening? Vince in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with David Korn from Mother Jones. Hi, Vince.
Good morning. I'm glad I'm not a sleeping teenager right now. I'm a big fan of both of you guys, so I'm honored to for you to take my call. Here's my question about Steve Bannon. He knew he talked to Wolf. He knew it was going to be in a book. He knows the book is coming out now. So his silence, I think, is very conspicuous right now. And with that crowd and their counter narratives and their distractions, what are the chances that you think that since he hasn't said anything publicly, there's nothing on Breitbart, he hasn't corroborated anything verbally since then, that Steve Bannon will throw a monkey wrench into the momentum by saying either A, I never said those things, or B, Wolf took them completely out of context?
It's a great question. And David, you know, Bannon did a radio interview this morning, I understand, on Sirius, saying he's still with the Trump agenda, no daylight. Trump says when Bannon lost his job, he lost his mind because of these quotes from the Wolf book. Maybe Trump is right. Why would Bannon dish all this dirt on Trump world, his world, to Michael Wolf, no friend of Trump, and then say in the next breath that he's all for Trump? So what do you make of that whole thing, including Vince's notion that by Bannon not disputing the quotes, that he's going to really, you know, put a dagger in the heart of Trump politics?
I don't think you're paying me enough to try to get inside the head of Stephen Bannon. I mean, it's really hard. I mean, he's done this before. Remember, he talked to Bob Kuttner, I believe, at the American Prospect,
Liberal Journalist,
and said all sorts of, you know, critical things. And this is when he was at the White House. So you know, he does tend to think highly of his own opinions and shares them in an unfiltered way. I mean, I was surprised by some of the things he told Michael Wolff, and as Vince notes, he hasn't disputed any of them. Yesterday, he put out a statement saying, "I'll let the book speak for itself," which means, you know, he's not disputing any of the quotes. On this radio interview, he did say the President of the United States is a great man. I know. I support him day in, day out. So he, you know, he's still, you know, I guess he maybe fears being cut off from the Trump base, which does support Breitbart. I mean, right now, the Trump White House hates Stephen Bannon, and the Republican establishment hates Stephen Bannon. And so what constituency is left for Stephen Bannon, except maybe the very Trumpy base of the party, which are the people who come to Breitbart? So I think he is going to try to preserve his standing with them.
But then why would Bannon, who really believes in this nationalist mission, even indirectly poison the well with that very base by doing things like calling Jared and Trump Jr. treasonous in a Michael Wolff interview?
All I can think of is that he didn't think of how this might play. That he was, when he's doing that, he is basically playing up his own role in this particular cosmos. I'm the real guy. I'm the guy who knows the Trumpism, national populism thing, and Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner. They're just elitists. They're just on for the ride. It's me who's done this. Me. And I think it was really his ego talking, and he might regret saying those things today these days. But he I don't think he thought through what the implications would be should those comments come out, on a national way. So I don't know. I mean, he did this interview early on in the campaign, in the administration with Reince Priebus at CPAC, I think last February. They came out and he showed that he could play nice, and then we're working together. I love Reince Priebus, which no one believed, but he showed the capacity to think about what to say in a public forum. But he seems, when it comes to talking to reporters, to do what a lot of people do, and it still surprises me. They just forget they're talking to reporters, and they just want to talk about their own agenda at that moment in time, and it's usually about self aggrandizement. And that seems to, his hubris here seems to have become his downfall.
By the way, snow day update. Listener writes, Brian Lehrer, no offense, but interrupting your substantive guest in this conversation for silly snow day alerts comes across as rude and distracting. So you can weigh in on that. And David, I apologize.
I it's fine by me. It's your show.
To conclude, pulling together the Fusion GPS op-ed, the Times Papadopoulos article, and now this Bannon stuff, I hear more people saying now that if the Russia investigation really nails Trump himself on something, it might be less about collusion to smear Hillary Clinton than about Trump's financial dealings with Russia through Deutsche Bank and real estate and things like that, that would leave him beholden to Putin, maybe even compromised like Michael Flynn was, because Putin knows about money laundering and things like that, the kinds of things that put Paul Manafort under indictment by Mueller, if these things, if Trump did these things, but that might be where the story actually ultimately goes regarding Trump. How much are you looking in that direction?
Well, a lot of people have been looking at Trump's finances, since he got into the race. They're very, very, very opaque. He uses lots of LLCs, which are basically shell companies that don't have to declare where the, often what their debts are, where their money is coming and going from. He's had a very unusual relationship with Deutsche Bank. When all the American and New York City banks stopped lending to him in the 90s because of bankruptcy, he ended up getting these tremendous lines of credit at Deutsche Bank, not through the main part of the bank, but through a private portion of the bank. And we do know that Mueller has shown, has gone looking for some Deutsche Bank records. There have been lots of stories about how, and statements from the Trump people themselves about how he's got money for his, real estate business over the years from Russian sources. We do know, and this to me I think is one of the biggest stories that's been underplayed, that while he was running for president, starting in the fall of 2015, he was considering and working on a deal, not more than considering. He signed a letter of intent with a company in Moscow to start developing a Trump Tower in Moscow. Now, think about this. He's running for president. He's saying he's going to put America first. But at the same time, he's saying all these positive things about Putin that everyone's scratching their head about. Why is he saying positive things about Putin? Well, if he said anything critical about Putin, could this deal go ahead? The Russian government has to approve, building permits and things like that. So he was basically double dealing on the American public by not telling them while he's running for president that he's trying to do a deal in Moscow. The deal ends up falling through in the beginning of 2016, but nevertheless, for 5 months while running, he was pursuing this. So there are a lot of Russian business angles that I, wish, would have been looked at prior to the election, but even still are worth looking at now. And, I've stopped making predictions, Brian, so I don't know what Mueller's going to do, or we didn't know a lot of the Papadopoulos stuff until recently. Mueller has shown a capacity to go far and wide and deep and surprise us. So I don't know. All I know is that the area of Trump's finances and the overlap with some Russian interests is an area that really deserves a good forensic deep dive, and it may take someone with subpoena power to get answers to those questions, things that journalists like myself and others who have looked in these areas have not been able to do.
So we will watch in all those directions, and we'll definitely have you and your co-author, Michael Isikoff, if you're willing, when your book comes out on the Russia investigation in March, I believe it is, to come on and do this in even more depth. Can I throw in one other thing that's not
it's your show.
Russia or snow-related with you? This is breaking news in the last couple of hours. I don't know if you've seen it, but maybe you have a quick analysis. Multiple news organizations are reporting, and I'm going to read this version from The Hill, that Attorney General Sessions will roll back the Obama-era policy that gave states leeway to allow marijuana legalization for recreational purposes. And this says, two sources with knowledge of the decision confirmed to The Hill that Sessions will rescind the so-called Cole memo, which ordered U.S. attorneys in states where marijuana has been legalized to deprioritize prosecution of marijuana-related cases. And the AP is on this, too, and says Sessions, a vocal critic of marijuana legalization, has hinted for months that he would move to crack down on the growing cannabis market. So just as a first impression to this story, from what you can tell, if you saw it before you came on or just hearing that, do you get the impression that Sessions just wants to empower U.S. attorneys to go after, marijuana dealers and stuff as federal crimes where they're serious enough? Or does he really intend to stop California, stop Oregon, stop Washington State, stop Colorado, Massachusetts too, from legalizing recreational marijuana with a federal mandate?
Well, I think the latter option that you just laid out is certainly a possibility. He may just want to start a new war, not even war on drugs, new war on weed, and see it through. The thing that's going to be that's so bedeviling about this is if you're giving the U.S. attorneys this complete discretion. So a U.S. attorney in one state may want to do exactly what you say, shut down all marijuana use, and a U.S. attorney in another state may decide, I'd rather go after real criminals and not spend time and resources on this. And so therefore we'll have a system which is really going to be pretty unfair, in which people will be treated differently in different states from a federal perspective. It's not a states' rights issue. So I see a lot of chaos in the future, and I would really want to know, as Trump or Sessions interviews U.S. attorney candidates, if they ask about this, is this indeed going to be a priority for them in choosing U.S. attorneys? Do they want people who will go after recreational pot users or not? There's a lot still to be learned here and to be worked out here, but we're going to have a system that's going to be a crazy quilt of enforcement, and that's really, I think, ultimately unfair and an insult to justice. It's not going to increase justice.
David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, thank you so much. Happy Snow Day.
Same to you, Brian. Always great to be with you.